On this edition of the Next Fan Up podcast, you're going to hear this.
I always look to our drivers, you know, the guys who take them to and from the airport, and I want to know what they were saying when they left us.
You'll also hear this.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I always have an opinion. I guess that's my what I'm known for, and most Jet fans are known for.
Oh, I've got more. Here's this.
Maybe we'll have Pod cut out the audio of me on this podcast like it happened last Sunday.
We're going to get the podcast started here now.
Listen. Hello? We go out, we hit people in the mouth.
You play to win the game.
Next Fan Up.
I want winners.
Featuring Pod Vader and the Superfans.
They are who we thought they were.
Did I bring this up last week? How? Why would I want anything but a winner? Why would I want losers? Losers would be kind of pointless. Hi, everybody. It's Pod Vader here again with another rousing edition of the Next Fan Up podcast. I have three super fans joining me and a very special guest, a guy that I knew from back in the ESPN days. ESPN, what's that? But in any case, let me introduce you to the super fans joining us for today's show. Back from sabbatical, I guess he was on assignment. It is our Steelers super fan, Greg. Hello, Greg.
Hey, Jay. I'm hopefully bringing back sanity to the podcast this week. Spoiler alert, Justin is no longer on here to be crowing crazy stuff about the sea chickens in the NFC this week. So,
and our other Thursday regular, Redskins superfan Neil. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Jay. How you doing? I'm looking forward to discovering more about the great quarterback class of 2000, which I think includes Spurgeon, Wynn, and T. Martin, and maybe some other half-decent quarterback?
Yes. We'll be talking about some of the greatest NFL draft steals in the past decade, although 2000 goes back a little bit further than a decade, but we'll talk about that. It was an article that was put out by Sporting News and a good topic, at least one for superfans to discuss. And speaking of superfans, I suppose even the Jets have superfans, and Andrew is our representative for that team.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to point out that that Chad Pennington is more than a half-decent quarterback. And he would have been more than a half-decent quarterback if his shoulder hadn't given out halfway through his career. So, Neil, get better use of adjectives.
I had somebody else in mind.
As always, you can tweet us at NFU Podcast. You can check out what we write. We write things from time to time, although I don't know if we've posted anything recently to our Facebook page, facebook.com/NFU podcast, or of course you can just search Next Fan Up. It'll show up on your browser nice and easy while you're on Facebook. And of course, we are looking for emails from you. We want to interact with you. So, you know, when we talk about articles like biggest draft steals, we want to have your input as well. Send us an email, nextfanup@gmail.com. And of course, when you find our podcast on iTunes, feel free to leave us a review. We have a few of them, but I've read them all already. And they're all fantastic. Even if you have bad things to say about us, I don't know if I want to encourage that, but I prefer if you have good things to say about us, then leave us a review and we'll read them here on the podcast from time to time. All right, let's jump into some of the latest news. And Reggie Nelson, the safety that we had mentioned last week, it was a surprise that he still was unsigned, is no longer unsigned. He is now a member of the Oakland Raiders. And boy, Monty, those Raiders are sure looking pretty at this point. Neil, what do you think about the Raiders right now? I mean, they are definitely in the lead contention for being my boyfriends this coming season.
Well, I think they're off-season champions so far. But as a Washington Redskins fan, we have numerous off-season trophies on our mantelpiece, and it hasn't really got us very far. I'm not buying it with the Raiders. I like us, Emily, and I like Sean Smith, but yeah, and Nelson, good pickup. He played 97% of Cincinnati's snaps last year, so he's going to be a guy who comes in and probably plays all 16 games. But I'm not sure about the Raiders. Let's see. They're in a very tough division, one of the best divisions in football. not the best division in football, but one of them.
Yeah, I think the difference between what the Redskins typically do in free agency and what Oakland has done this year is that Oakland is getting guys who are in the prime of their careers. I mean, not really Reggie Nelson. He's 33 years old, but he did lead the league in interceptions last year with 8. But guys like Sean Smith or Kelechi Osemele or Bruce Irvin, these are guys who are still on the upswing, and that's not something that you could have said about the Raiders in past years when they were signing guys like Justin Tuck in free agency, and those type of players were clearly on the way down. But it seems to me like the players around the league are starting to realize that Derek Carr is a legit option at quarterback, and that Amari Cooper and Latavius Murray and the rest of those guys on offense, also Clive Walford, who I'm a fan of at tight end, like they have talent, and it's just a matter of making that talent, having that talent execute, and that comes down to coaching. So we'll see if the coaching staff there, Jack Del Rio, is able to utilize the talent that Reggie McKenzie has put on the field for him this offseason.
I think they have talent, but I do wonder if they have depth. And I think when you get into the later part of the season, teams like Denver, Pittsburgh, they're going to show that they've got better depth.
Well, I'm just happy he left my division, so.
It always comes
I was
down to
ask,
Greg, you know?
Well, I was going to ask Greg. I mean, he apparently, as you just mentioned, he's out of your division. I mean, what does this do now for the Steelers when they face the Bengals?
Well, I think it removes a savvy defensive back it removes him from the defense, which they have to put a younger guy in. And Nelson had played very well against the Steelers in recent years. And he had been almost, it seemed like he was getting a read on them in general in their matchups. So I'm very pleased that he left the division and the Bengals got a little bit weaker. So that makes me happy.
Andrew, you had mentioned right before we started, as we are organizing and doing our show prep, by the way, you can check me out talking about show prep on the Podcasters Roundtable. I was on one of the last episodes there. There are rumors about the Bengals right now and Marvin Lewis perhaps on the hot seat.
Yeah. For years, every offseason, it seems like Marvin Lewis is on the hot seat. But the talent on this roster sort of indicates that he should be, because year after year, it seems like Bengals lose guys in free agency and don't sign anybody, and yet they have guys stepping up. Just for as an example, last year they drafted Cedric Ogbue, I think that's how you pronounce his name, for the first round of a tackle out of Texas A&M, and they took another Jake Fisher, a tackle out of Oregon, in the second round, and they lost Andre Smith, their right tackle. Now they're just plugging in one of those guys, and it seems like they have that at every position. They lost Reggie Nelson. Now they're plugging in Sean Williams, who's a guy they like very much, just to play a strong safety. This team doesn't usually invest much in scouting, which is a joke around the league. It seems like they have like Mel Kiper and Mike Mayock on payroll. Like they usually use their rankings, and so you'll see usually a lot of guys out of big schools going to Cincinnati, but it seems to be working out for them because they have a ton of talent, but they're still Marvin Lewis still 0-7 in playoff games. So until he wins a playoff game, I think he's going to be out next year if he doesn't pull that off.
That would be yet another loss for the Bengals that I'm sure, Greg, you wouldn't mind seeing happen.
No, if they were dumb enough to get rid of Lewis, I would find that amazing. One thing in my own sports allegiance is I'm a big Pitt fan. That's where I went to school and everything. And one thing Pitt has an issue with, as in Pitt basketball, Pitt football, is they remove their coaches once they get them to respectability. And the Bengals have been more than respectable. I mean, that's underplaying what they've done. But, I mean, if anyone watched football in the 90s and remember the Bengals, it's amazing what Marvin Lewis has done with this franchise. And for having what most people think is a flawed quarterback, I don't know how you can blame him, really. I mean, he gets them to the show every year to win a playoff game, just don't win the playoff game. So, I mean, that would please me very much if they fired him, because they'd probably go back to being the Bungles again.
Andrew, let's move on to the Jets, as they appear to have an opening still at their quarterback spot. I mean, how confident are you feeling about the New York Jets without Ryan Fitzpatrick at the helm?
Well, It's a matter of if you think he's going to be there or not. I still think Fitzpatrick is going to be there. But the big factor here is that the Jets front office doesn't think that Fitzpatrick can find money anywhere else. And it seems like they're right because Fitzpatrick is still out there. And all offseason I've been saying, I don't want to give Ryan Fitzpatrick $14, $15, $16 million, no matter what the quarterback market says. If Brock Osweiler is getting $18 a year, or Kirk Cousins is signing a $19 million a year franchise tender, enjoy that, Neil. But I just feel like the Jets know that they have Fitzpatrick where they want him, and that they're going to be able to get him at a $10, $11 million rate, which is good, which is a good contract in my opinion. Right now the reports are that they're offering 7 to 8, which is, it's too low for me. Even for me, that's too low. And it seems like they're asking left tackle DeBrickashaw Ferguson to take a pay cut so that they could give Fitzpatrick more money. But at the end of the day, Fitzpatrick's career has borne out that he is not the guy that is going to lead you to the Super Bowl. He's a guy who could be a caretaker. And now more than ever, especially after last year where Denver won the Super Bowl with absolutely awful quarterback play, competent quarterback play is sort of what you're looking for if you can't find a franchise guy, because it seems like you could actually be in contention with just competent quarterback play. But I'm not worried yet if that's the question that you're asking me. I feel like even if they do lose Fitzpatrick to a monster deal, which I don't see who's going to give it to them, I think that a guy like Josh McCown or a guy like that could be decent in Chan Gailey's system with those weapons. Or even a guy like Geno Smith, you guys are going to laugh at me, but he's never had weapons like that, like Marshall and Decker, or a running game like that they're going to have this year with Forte. So I'm not that worried. And I think the bigger factor for the Jets is that this year they're going to have a tougher schedule and they might not be as healthy as they were last year. So I think that's a bigger issue than the whole Fitzpatrick situation.
Oh, I salivate at the idea of a Geno Smith-led New York Jets squad. I would absolutely love for that to happen. But of course, I'm a Patriots fan. Neil, since Andrew threw a barb at you and your maybe overpriced quarterback, what do you think?
Yeah, maybe Kirk's overpriced, but he's in the building, and he's ready to go. I do wonder with Fitzpatrick if the problem is that he is asking for too much money, then when he starts lowering, or if he starts lowering his demands, I wonder if other teams will come in for him, and he will then just do a Brock Osweiler and decide to stick up two fingers to the Jets.
You like that?
You also have the problem with Fitzpatrick, well, with the Jets, is it's a salary cap, isn't it? I mean, they've got less than $1 million in salary cap space at the moment, and that's an issue. I think it'll take more than the Ferguson restructure to get them below that. I wonder, Andrew, who else might be restructuring or getting kicked out of the building?
Well, a guy like Bruno Giacomini, the starting right tackle, whose cap number is at $5 million right now, who they could basically wipe out if they cut him, would be an option. Also, Nick Folk, the kicker, who's making $2.5-3 million a year, he could be an option. It's so easy to clear cap space in the NFL, but what you mentioned about the cap space is 100% right, and which is why the Jets sort of have an alibi, if you will, because they're not just going to Fitzpatrick, listen, we're not giving you money because we're cheap. We can't afford to give you the money right now. And it'll be better for everybody if you took the $10 million, which is more than anyone else is offering you in the first place, if you took that money and came back to a system that you're familiar with and with two top receivers that you had such good production with, better production than you had at any point in your career. So if you're the Jets, I think you're playing this the right way, and eventually Fitzpatrick is going to realize there's no one else out there. And who's going to offer him the $10 million at this point either? The only team I could see is Denver, but they're the only team in the league who has a worse cap situation than the Jets, so they're going to have to clear up a ton of cap space too. So they both sides need each other, and eventually they're going to realize it and they're going to get it done. It's just a matter of when.
I wonder, is the draft an option in terms of getting a quarterback?
Well, absolutely. The draft is always an option. Mike Maccagnan comes from the Ron Wolf school of thought that drafting a quarterback every year is the prudent move to do. He did it last year with Bryce Petty, and I wouldn't be surprised if he does it in the middle rounds this year with a guy like Cardell Jones or Christian Hackenberg or Dak Prescott, one of those guys. I'd be shocked if they took Paxton Lynch at 20 overall. I think there are too many other holes in this offense to take another developmental quarterback in the first round when you already have a guy like Petty. But I could totally see them taking a guy in the middle rounds and trying to develop him and maybe carrying four quarterbacks on the roster this year.
All right. As we continue to talk about quarterbacks, Colin Kaepernick in the news, as it appears, there could be a deal with Denver and the 49ers. But before we get into it, why don't I talk about that with our special guest, as he has some keen insight into what's going on behind the closed doors and has an opinion on this potential trade. And that is Andrew Brandt. Here we go. It's my pleasure now to bring in our very special guest. This is a gentleman that I met while working at ESPN. Oddly enough, that's because he's the ESPN sports business analyst. He was a frequent guest of the Football Today podcast. He is an MMQB columnist. He's the director of sports law at Villanova. And of course, he is the former vice president of the Green Bay Packers. His name is Andrew Brandt, and Andrew, has been much too long to have you guest on my show.
Yeah, it's been a while. I'm happy to be here and good to be back with you.
I'm so happy to have you here, especially as, you know, our super fans are all geared up and they're getting ready for the draft. We have our own mock draft working right now. They're all pretending that they're the GMs of their team as we speak. I believe they're in round six of the draft. It's taken them about a week or so to get to that point. But I wanted to have you on specifically to talk about some of that behind the scenes stuff that happens right now with NFL teams. What, you know, we saw the movie Draft Day. I'm assuming that that is not what goes on behind the scenes with NFL teams.
No, definitely not. I remember reviewing that movie and it was just kind of sitting there shaking my head because it seemed like a lot of the maneuvering that was going on usually behind the scenes for weeks, if not months in real life, was happening on the day of the draft. So it's a movie, you know, and they were trying to show everything condensed into the one day. And of course, it had a love story with Jennifer Garner. I never saw any salary cap people that looked like that in my time in the NFL. But again, it was a movie. I think what happens now is, you know, these first on the scouting side, the area scouts were out starting in late July, August. The player personnel director is kind of over the top of them. The general manager is over the top of them. So that's what, 6-7 months of looking at these players over and over again, live practices, games, and all the tape. And then, of course, the interviews at the Shrine Game and the East-West game and the Senior Bowl and the Combine, and now you have the Pro Days. It's just an endless cycle towards the draft. The one thing that's going on now, I'd say between like April 1st and the draft, are these pre-draft visits where teams are allotted a certain number of players that they can bring in and talk to them in their facility. And what goes on is a lot of on the board, so they'll bring in a defensive lineman. Defensive coaches will put them on the board. You know, a coach will call out and say, okay, we're running a three under here, wanting a nine technique. Where do you go? What's going on here? And kind of sort of debating their football intelligence. And that's a lot going on. And it's probably a meet and greet. You know, I guess you are impressed with guys that come in their suit and tie and guys that come in, yes, sir, no, sir. But we always realize part of that's an act and part of that's rehearsed. One interesting tidbit is I always look to our drivers, you know, the guys who take them to and from the airport, and I want to know what they were saying when they left us. You know, I want to know if they called their girlfriend and said, yeah, I don't want to play there, because those are good things to know. Or sometimes, you know, you hear from the driver that he was talking to his buddies and saying, God, I hope they draft me. This place is great. Those things mattered. So you do your little intel on these visits.
At what point have teams pretty much made up their mind? I mean, is there a way that a player would sway you radically one way or the other at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think the board, that in my experience in Green Bay, it was always about the board. The board is really set up between like mid-January and the combine, the grinding of that month. And from then on, it's minor adjustments. You go to the combine, someone is a workout freak. Maybe you move them up half a round, maybe a round. That's about it. I mean, you're looking at a board based on scouting tape, based on measurables over a seven-month period. It's not going to be that different than what comes out in April. Now, again, there's some outliers that move way up or way down based on what happens in February, March, and April, but it's pretty much set up by the combine.
How much recruiting do the teams do? I mean, obviously the players have to make an impression on the team, but how much of that is reciprocated towards the player, especially one that they really want?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's not free agency where these guys have a choice. You know, if right. you take them, you take them. So I think there's some of that. I think, you know, in the visits, it's just more about coaching. It's more about facilities. You know, it's not wining and dining. The food they eat is the food that's in the facility. So I think a lot of this stuff is going to be all about football, at least from my experience, not much wining and dining recruiting.
Let's talk about some of those free agents. Although Colin Kaepernick's not a free agent, he's a guy that's been talked about quite a bit here lately, as it appears the Broncos and the 49ers have sort of a trade ready to go. It's just a matter of the player giving up a ton of money.
Yeah, this is the most interesting situation in the offseason to me. You have a player guaranteed to make about $12 million. You have a team that we think wants to acquire him, willing to pay about $7 million. And you have a team employing him that has been, I think, somewhat bland and noncommittal about him. Now, you put that all against the backdrop about 2 months ago with his agents coming out and saying, well, I don't think, you know, we want out. So somehow, some way, the Broncos, to me, have gained all the leverage in this negotiation. Forget about the, you know, what he's going to be traded for. You know, that'll be a third or fourth or fifth, whatever it is. They'll get that done. It's all about the contract. The Broncos just seem to be sitting back and like, let us know when you're ready. We'll give him $7 million, and I think they want to give him 14 over two. They want to lock him up 2 years at $7 million. So. And I just think they sit back and say, yeah, this is going to happen for us, because either the 49ers don't really want him there or he doesn't really want to be there. So two ways to make the $7 million happen. One, Kaepernick takes a huge pay cut, which I think is less likely. The other way is the 49ers pay off the deal. Now, it's not like baseball and basketball where you can include cash in the trade. But what they could do is say, okay, you make $12 million, we're going to give you $4 or $5 million of that right now in a bonus, and then your salary will go to $7 million, and then trade them. So it can happen. You know, whether anyone thinks it will happen or not, it just seems to me like, unless we have Chip Kelly or someone, Balky, saying, yeah, we're definitely keeping them, it's over. And until that happens, we're looking at, well, could be moved to the Broncos.
What would that do to the 49ers salary cap? How would that impact it?
Well, if they do that move, they would take on that $5 million and they'd get rid of the $7 million. So, okay. And then they'd get rid of the rest of the contract. It would be that simple.
Yeah, to me right now, as we look at free agency and the quarterbacks that are available, taking Ryan Fitzpatrick out of the conversation, at least for the present moment, because I haven't seen a lot of links to Fitzpatrick in Denver. I have to imagine, at least for the Broncos, that Colin Kaepernick is their best option at this point.
It seems like it. I mean, I think people are not sold on Mark Sanchez. He hasn't played, you know, that great for the Eagles in recent years, but, you know, he does have a history. And here's just what I think about the Broncos. Unless they're unless they're, you know, messing with all of us, is that they seem a lot less worried about their quarterback situation than we do. That's just the feeling I get about the Broncos. You know, they've let Peyton Manning retire and they let Osweiler go to a competitor. So they'll figure it out, you know, and if it's Kaepernick, great. They just seem to be feeling like if it's not Kaepernick, we'll deal with that too. So unless they're putting up a strong front, like I said, they seem much less worried about how they'll fill Osweiler's spot than we do. And I just have this suspicion it's going to be Kaepernick. And it may take a while. It may even take past the draft. I don't necessarily think the draft is even a deadline with this. But certainly by the end of by beginning of training camp.
The football world recently mourned the passing of Eugene Parker. You wrote a column for the Monday Morning Quarterback, MMQB. Tell us a little bit about Mr. Parker.
Yeah, it's a personal friend. And as someone in the business a long time, someone I really grew to appreciate, like, and trust. And there's not many of those in the cutthroat world of professional football. Eugene's been an agent for decades, represented superstars, Deion Sanders, Larry Fitzgerald, Emmitt Smith, Curtis Martin, and so many others. Always got top value, always did great deals. His signature ask was always shorter deals. So instead of a little bigger bonus and puffed up money in later years, he just wanted shorter deals so the guys could get to free agency faster. I dealt with him at the Packers on a lot of guys, Greg Jennings, Justin Harrell, Hardy Nickerson, Joe Johnson, and one I write about, which endeared me to him for life, really for life. And the story is this: 2004, first round pick, speedy cornerback from Arkansas named Ahmad Carroll. First round picks were really hard to negotiate back before the new CBA. We agreed a couple days before training camp we'd really knuckle down and get this done. And before that night, before that scheduled day, I had a good friend in the office, our player personnel director, Mark Hatley. He came by, wanted to help me out. I said I was good. He said he was going to play golf for the last time. And what he meant was the last time before training camp, because then he wouldn't be able to play golf. Things would get too busy. That was the last time I ever saw Mark Hatley. He died that night of a heart attack after playing golf. I was devastated, as all the people in the office were. And the last thing I wanted to do was negotiate contracts. And all these other rookie picks, where the agents were like, come on, Andrew, we got to get it done. And they're haggling over $1,000 here or there. I'll just never forget Eugene. He called me that night. He said, Andrew, don't you worry a second about Ahmad. We'll get it done. It'll be pain-free, and we'll do it whenever you're ready. You mourn for Mark. You grieve. And whenever you're ready, just give me a call. I will tell Ahmad we're not doing his contract right now. You know, in a world of business and relationships, you never hear that. It just struck me. As I said, it's something I'll remember the rest of my life. And I just mourn for Eugene, who had a bout with kidney cancer, just so loved by his clients. And it's rare to say this, but really loved by NFL people, because he was going to bring a tough deal to you, but he was fair. He was honest. He was respectful and kind throughout.
That's a wonderful story. It's, you know, it reminds people that work in the business world and have to deal with sort of inhuman things in numbers and money and things of that nature, that the person on the other side of that table is a person. And so to hear that kind of story is very warming. Speaking of, well, it's not really warming, but you wanted to talk a little bit about the concussion situation right now. What did you have in mind there?
Yeah, it's just been a back and forth for, it seems like, months. So we'll just pick it up a month ago in a congressional roundtable. The NFL senior executive on health and safety, Jeff Miller, made a comment, was asked a question: is there any link between playing football and contracting CTE? And he was sitting next to the doctor that has discovered CT in 90 of 94 brains examined. So he said, yes, there is a link. And of course, it became headline news, the NFL admitting this link. And then we see some backing off with Jerry Jones. And it just seemed to me it was a watershed moment. And I just think that the NFL has to get its act together. We have a concussion litigation that's being settled. It does not include coverage for CTE. The NFL has now said that Miller's comments are consistent with what has gone on with concussion research in the past, even though you have Jerry Jones throwing him under the bus when he was commenting about it. So again, I think what we need in the NFL is open and honest communication. And I think, like Jeff Miller said in Congress, like, yeah, that's a problem. So let's do something about it. Let's continue all this research. Let's figure out helmets. Let's figure out kids should not start until 14, 15 years old. And let's really get ahead of this instead of behind it. It's just sort of my soapbox that we keep talking about concussions, but we're afraid to admit that, yes, banging each other's heads can lead to future problems. Let's get that out in the open and then figure out how to deal with it.
Yeah, you know, I attribute this to you and a lot of the guys at ESPN as a father of a 12-year-old boy who absolutely adores the game of football, not allowing him to put those pads on until he reaches high school. The beauty of it is the NFL has done a great job with their flag football program, and I've been a participant in that for quite a number of years as a head coach, at least here on the local level. And my son, of course, has played now for a number of years, and it's fantastic. And I think that's a message that we can all do a better job of getting across. Not so much that Pee Wee football is wrong, just, you know, making sure that the parents understand, you know, what they're allowing their child to do.
Yeah, and I have a son that's 13 as well, and it hasn't been an issue because he's always gravitated towards soccer and basketball and other things. But it's a tough question. I know everyone asks, you know, what would you do? I don't know the answer. I mean, if he pushed it, I would try to make him wait. My only answer would be that he would stop if it was the first concussion. I would not allow continued football after the first. That's just my personal feeling.
Andrew, where can people find you?
Twitter is always an easy place. Andrew Brandt. I've got the name now, at Andrew Brandt. All my columns are at the MMQB on the Sports Illustrated web of sites. And ESPN, basically, you know, outside the lines, depending on the issue we're discussing, obviously SportsCenter and all those shows, when things come up in the business and legal aspects of sports, especially football.
ESPN, what's that? I've never heard of it. Andrew, thanks so much for joining me on the show. I will make sure that we do not spend this much time apart, and we'll get you on the show again somewhere down the road.
You got it. Good to talk as always. We'll do it again.
All right, guys, there was my interview with my old friend, Andrew Brandt. Let's revisit what he was talking about there with Colin Kaepernick in Denver, how he feels Denver is sitting pretty right now and has all the power and the leverage in this move. And ultimately, it's going to take the 49ers to be the ones that blink. They're either going to have an unhappy quarterback in Colin Kaepernick sitting and taking $12 million on their roster, or they're just going to have to pony up the $4 to $5 million to trade Kaepernick to the Denver Broncos. Greg, what are your thoughts right now on the Colin Kaepernick deal?
Well, if you would have asked me last year before RG3 sat out the whole year at $16 million against the cap, I would have told you that it's nuts to the Kaepernick. But after seeing that, I mean, you have to at least consider that as an option. I mean, Chip Kelly probably has a lot of time there being a new hire, and he's probably not going to make a mistake, or he's going to take his time not to try to not make a mistake. So I have no idea what to make of this, really, but I just think everything's in play, everything's realistic.
Andrew, I know you have an opinion.
Yeah, I mean,
I guess I always have an opinion. I guess that's my what I'm known for, and most Jet fans are known for. When it comes to Kaepernick and the whole situation going on, what I think is going to end up happening is the 49ers are going to ask the Broncos to up their offer on draft pick compensation in order for them to cover some of Kaepernick's money, because all sides, it'll be best for all sides. It'll be best for Denver, it'll be best for Kaepernick, it'll be best for San Francisco for Kaepernick to be playing quarterback in Denver this coming year. And I think all three sides, very similar to the Fitzpatrick situation, all three sides want to get it done, and it's going to get done. It's just a matter of how much money Kaepernick is going to be willing to give up, or how much compensation Denver is going to be willing to give up. It's just a matter of who is going to blink first, and someone is going to blink first, because I'll tell you this much, Denver is not going into the season next year with Mark Sanchez as their lone quarterback on the roster who has started a game. I've been there. It's not somewhere you want to be. And I know Peyton Manning played quarterback last year and did a pretty awful job at doing it, and he still won the Super Bowl. But Sanchez doesn't have Peyton Manning's recognition pre-snap, and doesn't have the ability to sort of know where each guy is going to be on the field at before the snap or right after the snap. That's been Sanchez's Achilles heel his whole career, is that he can't read a defense and that he's prone to turnovers. And I'd be very, very concerned if you were going into a season just with Mark Sanchez as your quarterback. But it's not going to happen. It's so not going to happen that as we started this podcast, a report came out that Gary Kubiak reached out to Johnny Manziel. Okay, so that just shows you how desperate Denver is to find another quarterback option. All right? So Mark Sanchez won't be starting opening night.
That would be interesting to see a quarterback core featuring Mark Sanchez and Johnny Manziel. I might pay to see that happen. I think that would be interesting. And as we, as the Superfan Super Mock Draft has been fired up, you guys have been moving along quite nicely, although things that I believe have slowed down a bit, and we'll be recording the Superfan Super Mock Draft, so all of you out there can hear exactly who your superfans picked for your team. That will be next week. We'll break that up into two parts, as the recording will be rather long, and we'll play that for you on Thursday and Friday next week. And of course, we'll make the finished product available on our Facebook page. But we'll have more details about that as they come along. But news in the draft, appears the Titans, or someone involved with the Titans, or maybe not. Maybe it's true that there seems to be a lot more interest in that Titans number one overall pick. Neil, would your team be interested in that number one overall pick?
No, not really. I don't think this is a... But if you trade up to number one, it's generally always on the lookout for a quarterback, and we don't need one. Maybe the Jets will trade up. Who knows? I would like to see the Rams trade up, get themselves a quarterback, but not Washington. Not Washington. We couldn't afford it anyway. I mean, we've hopefully finished our thing of trading all our picks away.
Let's not forget, when we refer to the Los Angeles Rams, it is the Los Angeles Rams of St. Louis. All right, Andrew.
Oh, yes.
So you're right. Neil's right when he says that you're typically going to trade up to number one to draft a quarterback. And I think the Rams would be the team to do it. But the one obstacle there is, if you're Tennessee, do you really want to trade all the way down to 15? And because it seems like Tennessee wants to trade down far enough to get one of those six top prospects in the draft, which when it comes to Bosa, Buckner, Ramsey, like those type of guys, Tunsil, they want to be able to get one of those guys and still pick up extra draft capital from a team. I don't know. Let's say San Francisco really likes Carson Wentz, and they're under the impression that Cleveland is going to take him. Maybe San Francisco trades up to number one, especially if they're able to get an extra pick in a Kaepernick trade. But I still don't see anyone trading up to number one. I still think Tennessee ends up staying there and takes Tunsil. I know a lot of people are saying they're going to take Ramsey. I just think having Mariota being protected by two top-tier tackles in Luan and Tunsil, it's too much of an opportunity to pass up. So I still see Tennessee being on the clock at number one when the draft comes.
I think trading up to number three is probably a more realistic option in the draft for teams.
Why is that?
I think Cleveland will probably take a quarterback too, and whoever's left over would be, I think San Diego would like to get out at number three and maybe get the 49ers or the Rams trading up to number three to get that second quarterback.
Yeah, but the thing is, San Francisco wouldn't be jumping anybody. The only reason San Francisco would trade up is if they feel, or if a team, or if San Diego comes to them and is like, listen, the Rams are offering us this to come up to number three. They're in your division. You both need a quarterback. They're going to take the quarterback away from you. What are you willing to give us just to move up three spots? Sort of what Minnesota did to Cleveland in the Trent Richardson draft, where Cleveland gave up a couple of picks to move up one spot to take Trent Richardson. Just another one of a brilliant long line of moves in Cleveland Browns history. But I don't want to get ahead of myself because something tells me in a segment later in this podcast, I might be eating my words when we talk about the Jets.
I think you're right, though. I think that's the exact reasoning for somebody moving up to that position.
Let's move on now to talk about a couple of articles that I saw over the week that make for great superfan discussion fodder. They came to us from the Sporting News. This particular one that we'll start with, Draft Steals of the Past Decade, was written by David Steele at thesportingnews.com, and links to both of these articles that we'll be talking about will be in our show notes, which you can see at blogtalkradio.com/nextfanup or on our Facebook page. I always put the show notes there. And at the quarterback position, this is where they've made their first mistake, because this was in the year 2000. Tom Brady of the New England Patriots, drafted in the sixth round, was the seventh quarterback picked that particular year. And I don't think you can argue too much about that being a steal and a half. Although, when you really look at it, Joe Montana, also considered one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, also drafted in the late rounds of his particular draft class. So it's interesting to note that two of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, late round draft choices.
Yeah, I mean, if we're saying 2000 is a decade ago, then what's like 1985?
Oh, well done. Greg, you had you have a quarterback a couple of quarterbacks may or may not fit this bill.
Yeah, they definitely don't fit this bill because they were both taken. Bradshaw was taken first overall and Roethlisberger 11th. But the Steelers have cut plenty of guys over their time, like Johnny Unitas and guys like that. When I was looking through possible ones of this millennium or whatever in the 2000s, I was wondering why they didn't go with Romo since he was undrafted. Not saying that he's better than Brady, but if you're trying to stay in a 10-year period, Romo was in 2003, so not quite the 10-year period still. But I thought Romo had some value there.
What do you think about that, Neil, the Cowboys being in your division?
Yeah, the Cowboys. Yeah, Romo was a great pickup as a free agent, but move on. Cowboys, I'm not interested.
The running back position, Darren Sproles, drafted in 2005, the fourth round, 130th overall, the 15th running back off the board. Andrew, will we see 15 running backs off the board by the fourth round in 2016?
Man, it's possible. I doubt it. But a thing that I think that's the lesson to take away from this entire process is to look at guys who tend to be undervalued. So a 5'8 running back out of a small school is likely to be a guy that's undervalued. So maybe if you look at a draft this year, you look at a guy like Kenneth Dixon maybe from Louisiana Tech, that he's a guy that might be undervalued. And when we get later into this process, when we go to the defensive tackle position, that's a position that has definitely changed over the years based off a guy who we're going to mention, just his build and his abilities are more valued now than they were maybe back then. So if you end up redrafting these guys again, you'll be able to look at their traits and say, oh, the league has changed, and this is and these players might fit now better in this day and age than they did in, let's say, 2005 when Darren Sproles was taken.
Well, I have no problems jumping ahead. You're referring to Geno Atkins. The Bengals took him in 2010 in the fourth round, 120th overall, and he was the 12th defensive tackle off the board at that point.
Yeah, and just by looking at a guy like Aaron Donald, who was taking taken in the first round a couple of years ago, and now is wreaking havoc all over the league, those type of guys owe a lot to Geno Atkins, because he was termed as deemed undersized at 6'1" coming out of the draft that year out of Georgia. And you might think, yeah, he's playing on the defensive line, you're undersized, you want the big guys up there. But it makes more sense if you're a short guy. It's harder for the offensive lineman to get underneath your pads, and it's harder for them to get leverage, and it's easier for you to get leverage. And now more than ever, especially with these quarterbacks getting rid of the ball so quickly, pressure up the middle is paramount. And a guy like Atkins is basically the prototype, and especially this year coming into the draft, guys like Sheldon Rankins, these guys are all being taken higher now than they were in 2010. So Geno Atkins, if he was taken in the draft this year, would be a top 10 pick versus when he went in the third round in 2010.
At wide receiver, Greg, we have Antonio Brown taken in 2010 in the sixth round, the 23rd wide receiver off the board. What do you remember about the 2010 draft for the Pittsburgh Steelers?
Well, he wasn't even the first wide receiver the Steelers took in that draft. They took Emmanuel Sanders in the third round because they had a vacuum with Santonio Holmes getting traded, I think, to the Jets that offseason. So not only were we not expecting Brown to make the roster when he was drafted, but he was also hurt the majority of his junior year in college. And so his tape was horrible. Everyone thought it was a waste of a pick just to bring in a punt returner. And boy, were we wrong. Brown right now is probably one of the best receivers in the league, if not the best. And the value of a six-round pick for him and the second receiver taken by the Steelers in that draft just shows how wrong and how everyone missed on him.
Next couple of positions actually are in the 2010 draft. At tight end, we've got Jimmy Graham, who was drafted in the third round, the fifth tight end off the board at that point. And the Raiders tackle Jared Valdir in the third round, 69th overall, eighth tackle off the board. Go ahead, Andrew.
Well, in that draft, there was another tight end taken in the second round who was probably, you're very familiar with, Pod, Rob Gronkowski, who is going to end up being the best tight end of all time, was taken in the second round, mostly due to back concerns, his injury to his back. He was taken in the second round, and Jimmy Graham was taken in the third. So two of the top tight ends in the league were both taken in the second and third round in 2010. Maybe that's why we haven't seen many tight ends go in the first round. Eric Ebron is one that comes off the top of my head, but it seems that most teams are waiting till the second, third, fourth round to get these guys, and they seem to be producing.
You know, Andrew, I am more than mad at you right now, because that was my little nugget to steal from everybody, that Gronk was in that draft class and he was the better tight end and how could he ever drop? But you do this to me every time you're on. It's so annoying. Gosh.
Well, maybe we'll have Pod cut out the audio of me on this podcast like it happened last Sunday too.
I didn't cut anything out of the Sunday podcast. I had nothing to do with that. The Sunday podcast, which will for now forever be known as the Next Fan Up Lost podcast, that doesn't exist. The Saints in 2006 took guard Jari Evans in the fourth round. He was the 10th one off the board at in that particular draft. The Patriots taking Dan Coppin, the center, in 2003, fifth round, fifth center off the board. And I guess that's sort of, you know, going back to the Gronkowski pick and the discussion about Gronk, you know, I think it has a lot to do with the number, like how many other guys were taken before that guy. And Jimmy Smith, Jimmy Smith. I got Jimmy Smith on the mind. Jimmy Graham, obviously being the fifth tight end taken off the board compared to Gronk, who I think was the first or pretty close to the first.
Second.
I don't remember. It's the second.
Grisham was taken before.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we get into talking about NFL draft regrets, we can certainly talk a little bit more about perhaps Gronk belonging in that category. We mentioned Geno Atkins at defensive end, Elvis Dumervil in 2006, taken by the Broncos, fourth round, 11th defensive end off the board. I mean, this is a draft where we expect, you know, the pass rushers to go really quickly, which sort of accentuates that point you made earlier, Andrew, about how the game has changed and how the draft has changed along with it.
Yeah, Dumervil is a guy, again, who was very, very undersized. And it seems like the NFL is in, I mean, some teams like the Patriots won't take a guy like Dumervil. Like they prefer their outside linebackers to be these big, long, rangy guys. But the rest of the league seems to be more prone to taking these guys now. And guys like Dumervil are to thank for it. He was a fourth-round pick out of Louisville, I believe, and he's been wreaking havoc for almost a decade now. So if you're – I can't really think off the top of my head right now, like an undersized pass rusher in this draft, I'm sure – I mean, Neal's on top of all that. But there are guys that have a lot to thank. There are guys who need to thank Elvis Dumervil and guys like Geno Atkins for sort of changing the game in a way. Or maybe they think the coaches. Either way, they're producing on the field, and that's allowing future players from college to be able to do the same.
It's really interesting to look at all these names and see other names sort of alongside them in terms of where they were selected. It does take me back to the podcast we had with Eric Galco, where we were just discussing, you know, what needs to change in scouting, because there's just so many great players here in this list. And you think, well, who's paying these guys to do the scouting? Because something is definitely being missed, to miss so many guys. And you mentioned it at the start with Montana and Brady, potentially the two greatest quarterbacks ever to play this game, and scouts couldn't see it. And you do, yeah, it frustrates me.
I think one thing, what happens there is that they see one trait, and they go, okay, this guy's too short to play the position, or this guy's hands aren't big enough. And then they automatically throw that guy out and don't look at his positive aspects and what we could do to accentuate those traits. And scouting's not a black and white thing. There are players who have busted who maybe in a different situation might have been superstars and vice versa. So it's very, if you're a scout, I think it's not a good proposition. It's not a good process to automatically rule out a guy right away. I mean, these are human beings we're talking about, you know, like guys can change. Yeah. So they could work harder. They could study more. So I think ruling out a guy right away over something he can't control, maybe a guy like Russell Wilson, who got taken after a punter, because he was 5'10", not just automatically ruling him out because of something he can't control or something that he might be able to overcome, is something that scouts need to be taking more into focus nowadays.
I think coaching and development of coaching, and like when you get a defensive mastermind like Belichick or like Dick LeBeau, who maybe can learn how to use an undersized James Harrison, really opens the doors for all these other guys that have been overlooked. Because I think that's the key to this whole draft thing, is what's available today, what's not in vogue, you have to figure out how to use that, because it's easy to get. It's easy to, you know, back in the mid-2000s, it's easy to get Dumervil because he's undersized. But how can you use him? How can you get value out of him? So the scouting is probably doing exactly what they're told. And I think the coaching is just how it's implemented. And that's probably where a lot of the blame and success should be placed on.
But I think also you see that that some teams want an outside linebacker who does everything, and then they'll take him in the first round, whereas and they won't take a defensive tackle in the first round because he's only a two-down player. But maybe those two downs he plays are the greatest two downs of any player that position of all time. So why not take him? I think there's a lot of risk here. I think what you see with coaches like Belichick is that he will take a player to play a specific role, and it may only be one or two downs or for different series in a game, but he'll play those role players rather than looking for the all-round superstar player who can do everything.
I've had enough of this Bill Belichick praise pod. Let's move on. Well, what's next?
The at linebacker, Adelius Thomas was taken 25th off the board at linebacker, 186th overall in the sixth round in 2000. 2011, Richard Sherman was taken in the fifth round, the 34th defensive back taken. I don't really know. I mean, I don't want to go around in circles about those particular situations, but I do want to talk about safety Tyrann Mathieu for the Cardinals in 2013. Third round, 17th defensive back overall. If we recall, what caused Mathieu to drop in the draft that year was that he was suspended from college for use of, at the time, illegal substances. Marijuana now being legal in many states, and the NFL is going to have to address that situation. But I don't see in the current state of the NFL any team that would justify taking a guy, even if let's say that they knew that Tyrann Mathieu was going to be the player that he has been. Any team would still take a risk of taking a guy that has that on his record in the first round. Greg, I certainly don't think Steelers would.
I think they would, but this Noah Spence coming out, about former linebacker from, formerly of the Ohio State, he got kicked out of school for doing whatever he was doing, but he's supposed to be a great talent, but he's undersized. A lot of parallels to Mathieu, and he's going to be the case study for this year. If he gets taken in the first round, which he's supposedly, a lot of people at the end of the first round are very interested in him. I mean, I guess we can't say the Patriots because they're not the pick, but would, Denver pull the trigger on him at the end of the first round? Would Pittsburgh? I mean, that's going to be the case study right there.
Well, Denver did last year with Shane Ray, right? I mean, Shane Ray had that coming out last year, and he was taken in the first round. And there's another guy coming out this year, Robert, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Kendiche, I believe.
Kendiche.
He was the top prospect coming out of high school, and he went to Ole Miss. And he was there was a story of him jumping out of his hotel room because he was using synthetic marijuana, which, if you're a chemist or if you know anything about it, is actually worse for you than real marijuana, than organic. The reason why players do that is because that doesn't get shown up on drug tests. And that, again, Pod's right. The NFL really needs to reform this whole drug program they have going on. But it's going to be interesting to see if Kendiche gets taken in the first round. And a story that came out a couple of weeks ago was that Kendiche was telling scouts and coaches at the combine that it wasn't his weed, that it was actually Laramie Tunsil's. But that was never confirmed. So it's very interesting to see if it was Tunsil's, if that comes out, if he would fall. But I don't think that's going to be the case because I don't think Tunsil will allow that to come out because Kendiche is already tarnished, and I don't think he would do that to his friend. I think he's going to let Tunsil sort of slide by. You know, boys will be boys. No narcs here.
If they change these rules on marijuana, I hope they do in the next 6 weeks so Brian can come back. Just saying.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Let's move on now to the draft, to the NFL draft regrets, another article that came out from the Sporting News. This one was written by Vinny Iyer. And I want to start with the Patriots, not because I'm a homer, but because I also haven't had a lot to say in this particular podcast, but also because their biggest regret, according to this article, would be drafting Tony Eason, number 15 overall in 1983, and allowing Dan Marino to be taken at number 27 to the Dolphins. And as we referred to earlier, Dan Marino is listed as the biggest regret for at least four teams on this list, including yours, Greg. So it's more a discussion of the fact that, you know, depending on the situation and depending on who the draft pick was, in this particular case, it's quarterback to quarterback. And there's no arguing that the Patriots would be a much different team with Dan Marino than Tony Eason, to the point where my favorite quarterback of all time, Drew Bledsoe, would never have been a New England Patriot. But, I mean, could the Steelers really look at this as a regret not taking Dan Marino?
They do look at it as a regret, but it's more of like a Monday morning quarterback thing because back in the 83 draft when I was 1 year old, they took what they thought was the next Mean Joe Green in the Gabe Rivera. And he, in his rookie year, was showing, like I think through like 10 games, that he was the next difference maker on the defensive line for Chuck Knoll. And then he had a tragic car accident that paralyzed him. So I don't know how you really regret taking, you know, a guy who fit into your philosophy of how to play football versus a hometown quarterback in Marino. But now that Marino's a Hall of Famer and Rivera's in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, there's no comparison. But at the time of the draft, I can't imagine that was the wrong pick.
But really, I mean, any team that didn't take John Elway, I mean, out of that class, that 83 quarterback class, I mean, you could say there were 23 other teams that the regret was Dan Marino.
What's funny is on the list here for the Baltimore Colts, they actually have the regret of passing up Marino for Elway because Elway refused to sign with them. So even if you did do the right thing and took John Elway, you still are on this list for regrets.
Neil, let's talk about your team in this particular article. The regret pick was Carlos Rogers, number 9 overall in 2005. You missed on the Packers starting quarterback, Aaron Rodgers, who was taken number 24. And again, I would say there's probably 23 other teams, with the exception of a few, including mine, that regret not taking Aaron Rodgers before number 24.
Yeah, I think there must have been some mistake there. I think when they handed the card in, somebody had written Rodgers without a D, and we ended up with Carlos, I'm afraid. Actually, Rodgers had some good seasons for San Francisco. He was not too bad with us, but clearly not Aaron Rodgers. I've got to be honest with you, Pod, when I was scrolling through this slideshow, I was thinking, oh my God, what disasters are going to surface for Washington here? And actually, in comparison to some of the other picks, it's okay. I'm not too worried about this one. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Well, I'm sure you're not when I have to follow you up, right?
Yes,
well, I saved the best for last. I saved the best for last, Andrew, because your regret pick, the Sporting News has decided to go back to 1980 when the Jets chose wide receiver Johnny Lamb Jones, number 2 overall, and passed on the guy who went at number 3 overall to the Cincinnati Bengals.
But we're on to Cincinnati.
Tackle Anthony Munoz.
So, yeah, there's no doubt that's an awful pick. And for most teams, that would probably be their most memorable. But I think anyone listening to this podcast would be like, that's not even in my top 5. You know, the one that comes to my mind would be taking Kyle Brady over Warren Sapp or taking Ken O'Brien over Dan Marino. The thing about the Jets draft decisions is that when they're made, people know they're a mistake right when they're made. The crowd reacts. It's crazy. Like there's a video on YouTube, like Jets draft blunders, where they're interviewing fans right after the draft. They're like, all the reports were saying that the Jets like Marino. They like Marino. I mean, I wanted them to take Marino. Maybe they know something we don't. And then when they take Kyle Brady, the whole crowd's chanting Warren Sapp, Warren Sapp, and then they take Kyle Brady. And turns out Jet fans were right. I mean, they're not usually right about most things, but it seems like they know their draft prospects. But my personal favorite, I mean, I don't know if favorite would be the word, but in 2005, the Jets went to the playoffs, and they went to the playoffs in 2004, and I'm sure Greg remembers this game. In the divisional, they beat San Diego in the first round, and they went to Pittsburgh to play the Steelers in the second round, in the divisional round. And Doug Bryan, the Jets kicker at the time, had two opportunities to send the Jets to the AFC title game, and he missed both kicks. And Pittsburgh ended up winning that game, and I believe they lost to the Patriots in the AFC title game that year. But the Jets say, this is evidence that all we are is a kicker away from making it to the Super Bowl, so let's take Mike Nugent in the second round, which is the highest a kicker has been taken since Sebastian Janikowski. Guys like Vincent Jackson and Frank Gore and Justin Tuck were all on the board at the time, and the Jets figured, yeah, let's take Mike Nugent. And Mike Nugent lasted about 2-3 years on the Jets and has been kicking for the Bengals ever since, doing a very good job there. So not only did they take a kicker in the second round, they didn't even get the production that Nugent provided Cincinnati. So good job all around for the Jets and when it comes to their draft history.
We've got to be the dumbest team in America in terms of playing the game.
Or drafting. I invite you all to go check out these articles. We're not going to go in through every single team. I did want to mention a couple of right off the bat. It was done in alphabetical order. But the Cardinals taking quarterback Kelly Stopher, number 6 overall in 1987. The Hall of Famer cornerback Rod Woodson, number 10 overall, went to the Steelers that year. And then the Falcons, of course, taking number 1 overall in 1988, linebacker Andre Bruce. Anybody remember him? Didn't think so. Hall of Famer wide receiver Tim Brown, number 6 overall, went to the Raiders that year. And honestly, we could have a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking with drafts of old, and we did it ourselves with our super fan super mock drafts. But in all honesty, something that we may want to consider doing here down the road, and I'll suggest it to our Sunday guys, is looking at the number one busts of all time, because that's always a fun look. And Andre Bruce is certainly going to be pretty high on that list.
One of the great picks there is in 1979 when the New Orleans took a kicker. Or a kicker slash punter in the first round, I think number 11 overall. What would happen this year in the draft, do you think, if the Jets selected a kicker in round one?
Mel Kiper's head would explode.
Yeah. I think they're lucky the draft wouldn't be in New York this year. I think it's in Chicago. If that was in New York, it'd be a riot. There'd absolutely be a riot. And I don't think no GM would be able to get away with that in this day and age with social media, with everything going. I think that there would be too much outside pressure if a GM took a kicker in the first round. I think there'd be riots outside the team facility, and that guy would eventually lose his job. I don't think anything like that is going to happen. I mean, who knows?
Even a kicker slash punter, somebody who could save you a roster spot.
You mentioned the draft in Chicago. Just to throw them in here, in 1998, they took Curtis Enos, the running back, at number 5. They could have had Fred Taylor at number 9, who went at number 9 to the Jaguars. But, I mean, that's also a fun exercise, you know, to follow up on. And that's been done with the quarterbacks. You know, we had Drew Bledsoe versus Rick Meyer. If the Patriots had drafted Rick Meyer, how much worse off they would have been. If we had Peyton Manning and what's his face there? I don't know why. Thank you, Ryan Leaf. I don't know why his name escaped me right at that particular moment. But, you know, there's always been those great conversations of drafts past that we can revisit. And perhaps we will on future episodes of Next Fan Up. Please tweet us at NFU Podcast. Send us your email, nextfanup@gmail.com. If that's a topic you'd like to dive in with us, we would certainly appreciate your participation in our podcast. And of course, you'll be able to see a lot of things that we do on our Facebook page, facebook.com/NFU podcast. Leave us a review on iTunes. If you download us and listen to us and enjoy us, I guess even if you don't enjoy us, I did say that we would we'd take those reviews as well and read them on the air. We could be defensive about it, perhaps. Or I can unleash Andrew or Patrick, our Patriot superfan, on you, because they will come at you with full vim and vigor.
Nobody deserves that.
Patrick is on Twitter now. And if you only knew some of the things he does on our Slack conversation groups, if he brings that out to the public world, I don't know what we've done. We may have created a monster.
My Twitter timeline has never been the same.
So with that, I thank you, Greg. I thank you, Neil. I thank you, Andrew. I thank Andrew Brandt for joining us on today's show, and we'll definitely make sure he comes back and joins us at some point here down the road, especially when we want to get into some of those behind the scenes topics. You know, his time with the Green Bay Packers, he's definitely a guy to to get some good insights on what's happening in the background in the NFL. And with that, I leave you with Jeff Fisher, who will remind you.
Well, I think we learned today that, this game is four quarters long.